mi lo ha chiudi a che se sarà fin qual un poeta se qual to Paul Casey as up on quella for some chapter so no now yen is for two one Paul Banin Don Asquela I guess need all of you Paul Rojas in the gym anyhow I am very sorry this end I arrived without any point Irish had a reason for that that was a mistake. The first few poems I have here are they're in chronological order. First one, I tried to think back to what was the first thing I could remember. Bethlehem in Wexford, 1949. Distant and indistinct, dredged from the debris of memory, stomping home in snow with father and brother to find our mother, who loved surprises, had created the best yet. For there in the drawing room, already shedding needles, was a tree, with our first Christmas lights, tiny coloured lights running in and out about the spilling branches. On the sideboard, a real crib of crinkly charcoal paper with foreign figures minding baby Jesus on a straw floor. High above its cottony snow, a glistening star reflected silvery snatches of wonder, when from our kitchen came the scent of frankincense and mirrors. Passing time, 1951. Summers of stultifying boredom, dragging with desultory kicking in college grounds, deserted but for two small boys, one lean and athletic, the other heavy-headed, devoid of sporting tricks, waiting real meaning, barely sensed by them in drowsy Wexford town. Football soon forgotten came slitter and bossed ash, virtuoso runs and clashes, knuckles graze and fingers thick. I'll tell Mammy, came that wail again, above a taunting solo to running O'Hare commentary on Rackard, Love and Guillaume. Slow time of stretched impatience, longing for life in the constipating heat. Mealy mites, somebody read this, didn't understand what it was about. Mealy mites were little insects that infested flowers in the day before chemical additives were added to our food. They were seen in the original sliced pan, nicely burned to a dark speck. They were harmless, but disgusting on the same. St. John's Road mornings, Wexford 51. On shivery mornings, the porridge was hot in a thick yellow buttery sea, as windows fogged by steam and breath hid a seven-voiced hullabaloo. Tea with brown bread fried in dripping under a yellow yolk egg, and the fat of the rasher clotting the plate of sausage black pudding in lard. The daily bread, so casually made, with fistfuls of flour and bran, gobbets of buttermilk souring the wedge, and the rare delight of potato cakes with melting butter and salt. Before into the fog and the chattering choir, like a pagan entering our church, came the chemically white sliced pan. The end of our innocence, perfectly fried, as we held it up to the electric light, searching that manna for heaven, and finding there only meal mites. My father used to suffer from long protracted periods of depression, especially when his horse was lost. But when he was in his brighter periods, he had a great voice and used to sing a lot as he shaved in the morning. And it's a memory that has stuck in me now. It's a deep baritone, low baritone voice. His voice, muffled in melancholy, brown tones that sang bright and true above the shaving brush, faded now, forced flat by time and weariness. Across that sluggish estuary, whence once the future beckoned, an oyster to be dredged, prized open, slid, and savored. My mother was tiny, and there were five children, and she was an indomitable woman, and she was really very strong, but at times five children all close in age would wear anybody out. The little controlling girl. Stop that commotion or I'll tell your father when he comes home. I can't control you at all. That's where our mother made the mistake that brought five pleading voices from three rumpled beds. The little controlling girl, chanting the raucous refrain that rang from hearts full of freedom now Daddy was gone. The little controlling girl can't control her kids. The little controlling girl, repeated in rhythm when sleep wouldn't come, can't control her kids. Till that night she climbed up and from scarified heart pleaded the end of her tether. So when she went down we lay there confused, and after the fight we hummed low and quiet, the little controlling girl. In her ear, in the hovering hospital hush, I whispered a line buried 50 years deep. And a faint from the edge of the universe came, on a faraway rasp like a rusty gate. Can't control the kids. And then I hit, I was brought up in Limerick, well after Wexford, we went to Limerick and spent my teenage years there. And I went to the Jesuits, to the Sacred Heart College, the private. Taking studies seriously, oh, I should tell you that Studies was a quarterly magazine, which was an intellectual magazine run by the Jesuits and had been going, I think it started in the 1920s or 30s. That's all. It is still going, yes. I hope they'll publish this. Taking studies seriously in 1959. Jesuit boys, the Jays called us. I, aware of danger, a civil servant's son, when they were civil, when their sons had better be so too. He, from an important family, was safe. Until on a night when light from reading clerics' windows fell through gleaming rain on a green iron building housing Studies Quarterly Review. He, to win a bet, set out to prove that with a little card he could slip the lock of that secluded shed at the far end of the yard of Student Hall on Hatch Street. First steps on the gravel scattered crunching echoes off wide-eyed windows and robber-trapping walls. There could be no escape. Reading future news, I tiptoed lightly. Secure in family faith, he sent busy burglar scratchings bouncing from the tall forbidding walls. Click! He stepped inside, motioned me behind. I died, and dead, could not refuse. Trophy taken, silence tested, resurrected, we crunched gravel in retreat with a borrowed copy of the Jesuits' Review. He strode. My feet rose higher than they should. The disillusionment of angels. The air hangs heavy, fully laden. How dull the seeping evening, humid, windless, strange. Ennui suffuses every being, and silence plays ventriloquist, distant mooing muffled in the grass. But now, a shy, reluctant smile cracks heaven from the sea. The horizon slowly, quietly splits a long and crimson gash upon the deep. The stage is set with wrinkled floor. A grey backdrop above the cerise slit holds lacy hints of backlit eggshell blue that ease to greys of folded tones wisping to their zenith far above. Through rends in that grey backcloth, the sun sends bright, steep-angled shafts whereon, if heaven really does exist, at least once in man's observant reign, exultant little angels should have graced the scene, vying as to who is best and sliding from celestial heights, to bump down here in Miraculous amongst a dumbstruck audience. Thais is mentioned in this next poem, and Thais was a courtesan whom Virgil referred to as a putana, which is a slang word for a whore. Penance. For Esmond, Jacob, and Oscar, three of my grandchildren. Penance. To he who wiped his finger on the bathroom wall, I wish a ghost from Dante's hell would come and beckon him to follow, not with Virgil as a guide, but a grotesque minotaur to drag him down to Circle 8. Malevolge is the stinking pit so proper to this turd. He should languish there forever with that sad putana Thais, slave to her of such bad sex and suppurating wounds, whose malady is such that she will never sit again, as so graphically described by Alighieri, a wretched poet, in that splashy pit of excrement so stinking that the eyes of all their sinking are streaming wet desire to cut from skulls the smells, spit from mouths the acrid taste of crud like that which marked the bathroom paint. There he'll retch forever, or slip down even deeper to ninth circle of white flames, held for traitors to their patrons, where he'll meet Beelzebub, whom I'm sure he will bamboozle with his luck of tender innocence, even ignorance of sin. Well, he may bamboozle Beelzebub, but he'll not dodge that inferno, so intensely blazing as to fast evaporate the molten sun. There he'll scream for quick return to the relative soft sucker of the steaming acrid stench of voided bowels. But Satan's hateful devils, who strut about like monkeys, will nudge and prod and trip him, then flail him with their tails, while with their sharp barbed goads they rip the roasting flesh from he who wiped his finger on the bathroom wall. And for three other grandchildren, named Michael, Thomas, and Hemer, and that's relevant. The True Nature of Humanity, Christmas 2011. Be it instinct, be it not, nature set in kernel stone nestles deeper in the heart than schooling in or out of home. Chuck intoned an incantation so arcane to human ear that Bud gave urgent orders terse in race to save the universe. While Emer sat and nursed her baby, brave men geared to fight invasion, Wogans who might kill or maim in distant spheres galactic name. As spaceships hovered into sight, all noise and glow and spinning hazard, ferment there on the earth grew frantic, pilots spinning round were airsick. Now Bud and Chuck, in proving metal, swooped and darted through the melee, drowning spacecraft, nuclear maybe, while Emer fought to save her baby. Until Chuck's head was nearly lost as misdirected friendly fire, an elbow, out of ground control, met a fine fast spinning ear, and strife turned internecine. While Emer tried to hide her baby, born last night by man in red, who slay slide above the nation, ended in this space invasion, which led to Michael, alias Bud, almost detaching poor Chuck's head, which really sat on Thomas, as Emer watched the chaos. Be it instinct, be it not, nature set in kernel stone nestles deeper in the heart than schooling in or out of home. My wife comes from Denmark, so we spend a lot of time there. And this is now Copenhagen. Copenhagen, March. Mint sun shafts the being, rends skeleton trees, slashes ancient walls, shatters windows. Spring assaults winter in Copenhagen. Humped frozen piles, gleam encased in grime, slowly writhe on city sidewalks. crunch cracks the brittle air. Winter resists spring in Vietnam. For some short hours each day, splendor rehearses shedding its icy coat of glistening white, prepares for wider sun, less fearsome, when birds will sing again and hearts accept the dappled spring in Copenhagen. Memory for Jette, my daughter, my eldest daughter, who lives there. Memory. Bye-bye, Jette.
Sorry.
She warned me. She had to leave.
Last one.
Last one upset.
I know, memory for Jette. At 36,000 feet, my height does not matter. At 36,000 years, it will not be a worry. But when I hit the ground again today and walk amongst the milling throngs of Dublin, it would be nice to rise just 6 short inches more, be 6'2" in stockings, and see across dark shoulders dandruff lightly sprinkled, to remind me of the scattered snow and sunbeams splicing ice-cold air on Aarhus Plassen as rice was thrown at Jette's wedding. And in memory of Lisbeth's mother, Esther's home, a submerged erstwhile redolence infuses memories of Advent evenings in that warm house beneath a beckoning star in Danish snow. Wax warmed to flame across the waft of baking from the busy kitchen brings back a welcome as kind as any candle, red and resting on a sprig of holly, awaiting an arrival. Soft light, low shaded lamps, and guttering candle smell, candles everywhere, shyly shunning shade and turning thoughts to kindliness and family. The gleam along high polished wood brings the scent of beeswax and elbow grease, memory of the work performed for Knud the father and their war-born brood who bound her to the family wood. And stealing presents. I would steal gold halos off the saints, red bloom from autumn apples, and dewy threads of cobweb clinging to hang in your sleep's chapel. I would make that church of softest down, combed from day-old wings, strip fragrant bark to line your cot from eucalyptus bones. I would dive into the deepest sea to capture phosphorescence, strip the scales of blue and green from mackerel's flashing presence. I would fill your ears with soughing leaves, quiet humming from massed choirs. Peaceful doves would soothe your ache, soft bells float down from spires. Fox, I was looking out the window at home one day some years ago, actually quite a few years ago, roughly about the time I started writing poetry, and I saw something there. Fox, with spirit sprung on limber gait, there lopes the loosely looping sloop that sloops beneath the apple trees. First visit from lithe miracle of grace draws the watchers through the glass to hints of something carnal from their past. Call softly to the child to come and feel genetic intimations here, full brush of sadness for lost state. And clutching for protection the still child, the fleeting thought springs through the adult mind. Who is protecting whom, from what, and when? This one came after as we were going to a symphony concert in Tralee of all places. we heard on the radio coming in about a young man who had been killed in a car crash. And the soloist in the concert was an absolutely stunningly beautiful young girl. She was about 17 or 18, and she just played so beautifully. Violin concerto in E minor. Mendelssohn Under White Light. A 19-year-old waiting with heart beating to the maestro's sway, before coming in on a rising phrase of autumnal tone that climbed through a swirl of seasons. Did the recklessness of youth play a part in her success? Silence Under White Light. A 19-year-old waiting with heart beating to the maestro's sway, before going out on a diminishing phrase of autumnal tone that fell through a swirl of seasons. Did the recklessness of youth play a part in his failure? And I love music. And a couple of years ago, we were at Bodo Stenson, the jazz pianist, and his quartet were playing in Dunleary in Dublin. At the Boo Boo Stenson Jazz, great thinkers often grow through music in their youth, melding from both hemispheres slight threads to woven ropes. I watched Boo Boo's fingers make great magic on the keys, the right hand sprayed arpeggios, the left insistent chords. Those two halves at work impressed. But then I saw the drummer play everything in sight, the floor, the stands, the drums' backsides. He saw the cymbals into parts, did it with delight, four limbs and head in unison, their battles synchronized. I saw a mind grown through the years, not only in two parts, for I was watching genius there, five segments now at dance. And then I heard in Dingley, a classical guitarist, Pat Coldrick, and I was astounded. I never knew an Irishman could play guitar like that. I expected him to play like a hurler come from Spain, awkward fingers skinned, inarticulate in his wheeling of the round boss stick, for he hadn't tried it spring while in his cot. Instead, his solos were the essence of quick wit, dexterous arpeggios springing string to string, the clash of ash replaced by rounder tone from sounding board of spruce and maple neck. The neck that nestled lightly in his hand, like the come on flashing sure in tune, and racing to the beat within his heart, heard music like a slitter to the lark. We're getting towards the end. The singer, the fretful hum, the anxious eyes, the beads of sweat, and then to see him exude confidence, striding center stage with gracious smile, to face a sea of fine white teeth, 500 critics in the dark. The maestro wafts his wand, a piano strikes shy opening bars. He fills his lungs, arcs soft palate, and lifts a stream to vocal folds, spinning beauty from their pleats, and sending round harmonics ringing past the listeners' seats to wake the hall's back wall. From open-throated soaring, he plunges to the richness of the chest, plucking of the hearts behind the teeth, choking breath, blunting knives. He crests the final height, then falls, plunging down a steep triad to held-breath halls. Clapping, drips, then trickles, drop on drop to tumbling torrent. The singer, relieved, slips from well-feigned nonchalance to ease. Noel Kenya and I left John B. King's pub late one night during the Writers' Week, just gone by, the Slow Writers' Week, And I noticed across the road on a corner two fishermen, and they just looked like a bronze statue there in the light, and it was drizzling heavily. Fishing in the gutter at a small town corner, bronzed by the yellow of a filthy night street light, two booted men, tall and small, dragged at fags. Gleaming oilskins shedding sheets of rain, grounded green hearts wavering above spilling sou'westers. Intimate, stone still, but for the regular lifting of cupped hands, to inhale a contradiction to the day spent casting flies on the field. And this is one, I just wrote this recently, this is the last one. I thought I'd bring it along because it tells a bit about where I live. And I refer to the twite in this. And the twite is a small finch of linnet shape that I didn't know about until recently. It's of linnet shape and size, and they're becoming extinct because of the new farming practices that are doing away with their habitat. I'm not sure about the name of this one because, as I say, I've just written it, but for the moment I'll call it Serenity. The sea, inarticulate and raging, goaded from south and west, beats the cliff with hammer blows. The mountains, rearing back, stare the violence down. And when their silent gaze makes shy the waves, the sun comes out from flying clouds and bathes in warmth that timeless shelf, the edge of the peninsula. There can be seen the minutiae of this place, all brown from ravishment by salty spume. But look, between the rust and stone are found sea pinks and holly, chamomile and more. A myriad of colours would defy aesthetics in any other place. After storm's great thunder, the sense of peace is shocking. It makes birds piping loud, from herring gull to dying twite. And in the summer lull, my thoughts turn in again. I don't notice nature's changes unless they are abrupt. Sometimes, though, I peek, then stare and wonder at the freshness of the world. The guileless air, salty, passes slowly inland, caressing mountain sheep and cattle near the cliffs. Oh, look, the grass has grown, wildflowers are blown, and the heather on the hill is turning purple. Must cut the hedge if I have time, pay the man who cuts the grass, find someone to paint the house, if I remember. Ah, there's my friendly neighbour. Hi, Sean, up Bassinineshire. Now back to life inside my head, reviewing scenes of interest. The landscape here is potent. There is no better place, unspoiled by friend or stranger, where thoughts roll on like thunder, or subtle summer slumber in a headscape made for wonder. Thanks very much.